Hello and welcome to the Brain Trust Live Legal Spectacular.
Hey y'all, I'm Brent.
I'm Lila, and you can find us on the web at www.braintrustlive.com. We promised you a legal spectacular, two words that almost never get used together, and we have it for you today. We have our in-house legal expert, Ben Sofness. He's a former partner from Kellogg Hansen in Washington. He works as an in-house lawyer at a tech company that he is not here to represent because he is here in his personal capacity, because legal disclaimers are part of being a lawyer. Anyway, welcome back, Ben. Thanks so much for coming back on.
Thank you, Lila. It's so good to be here. Hey, Brent.
Hello.
So I feel we kind of pushed a bunch of legal topics off so that we could talk about them on this podcast. And that worked out great because last week was chock full of election news. But before we even get to some of the more timely legal conversations, we really thought of the idea of doing a legal panel like weeks ago because of the Trump indictment. So Let's start there. I wanted to ask your thoughts about this in particular because I noted on the podcast and also to myself personally and every person that I spoke to that day that the coverage of that day seemed to kind of evolve in an interesting way where everyone was very excited. All the TV pundits like could not contain their glee at watching Trump's like hilarious OJ style drive to the court and his little like sort of would be perp walk type entrance to the courtroom and his disappointed look, which we all loved seeing. And then as soon as they found out what the counts were, they got very kind of like depressed because they didn't seem splashy enough. And then everyone on the internet was like, are these good? You know, is this like a strong enough case? So can you tell us a little bit about your thoughts about the Trump indictment case and the excitement of that day?
Yeah, sure. I mean, look, I think it was just like the pandemic when everybody became, you know, on Twitter became like an expert virologist, and then everybody became an expert on sinkholes, and then everybody became an expert on.
To be clear, we have been experts on sinkholes since the beginning. There are no two greater experts. Continue.
Right. No, I remember on, I think it was around Elon Musk buying Twitter, I became an expert on corporate acquisitions.
Of course.
And to this day. No, I think it was like, look, falsifying a business record is not the splashiest sounding thing, but I don't totally buy it. And I, you know, let me walk through like very quickly what the charge is and then why I think it's sort of actually kind of, you know, could stick. So basically the splashy take was they have a big problem because falsifying a business record, basically saying you were paying for one thing, but it was something else, is a misdemeanor. And to make it a felony, that is to say like a crime that you can be imprisoned for more than a year, something that we would care about, you have to falsify a business record with, and this is the important part, the intent to commit another crime. And everybody's saying, okay, great, he commits lots of crimes. The other crime was probably federal campaign finance crimes. And the hot take was, well, can the New York DA in a state, you know, judicial system really go after him for intent to commit a federal crime? Typically, you have to do that in federal court. I think that's fine because, like, in a nutshell, they don't have to prove he committed federal campaign finance crimes. They just have to prove he had the intent to commit federal campaign finance crimes. And it's a different question. And it's just not that weird for one legal system to, you know, ask a question about what another legal system thinks about something in proving its own crime. It's a New York crime, doing right. A false business record with the intent to commit some other crime. That is a New York crime. And I don't see that as being that tough.
And I think there was also, weren't people sort of like upset that day that like, it wasn't clear what the second crime was, like that it wasn't like what he was intending to do as the second crime was. And like, I think Bragg even got asked about it, but like, he doesn't really have to say that now, right? Is my understanding. That's, like, is there any particular reason like why he wouldn't have put that in the complaint?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, I should be clear up front. I'm not a criminal lawyer. I'm not a prosecutor, but yes.
Oh, I thought you were about to announce not being a criminal too. And I was like, thank you for that disclaimer.
I am both not a criminal, that's so important. Not a prosecutor, not here in my professional capacity, as has been made repeatedly clear. Just me, a, you know, guy who went to law school. But, you know, no, I like a complaint, which is what you file at the start of a case, is like a pretty boring document in which you do everything you can to include every possible allegation that you might use later. And you want to leave yourself a lot of room to, like, you're going to then enter the discovery phase of the case where you and the other side exchange evidence, and then your legal theories might change and might evolve. So it is not going to be the splashiest document. It's certainly not going to be succinct. It's not going to be press release ready. And so, you know, the legal press, even if on their best day, are going to have to, like, read the whole thing, pick out maybe the buzziest parts, and might miss kind of what's really interesting. I mean, so I think we don't know exactly what the second crime will be, but that's okay. You can leave yourself with a few roads to go, and they certainly don't have to be pot committed at this point.
Can you explain to us, like, once a case like this starts to proceed, like, what happens? So we all know we're waiting for some next step that is not going to come for months. And when it comes, it's going to be, we're going to have forgotten about how exciting the day of the arraignment was. And we're going to be reminded by Van Jones or somebody on television who's not going to accurately represent the glories of that day. But what is going to happen in the sort of next phase of a case like this?
So, okay, short answer, can I tell you, is no, because it really is special to criminal law. You can cut this if you want. But but in any basic, like, litigation, you file the complaint, that starts the process, and then you do a bunch of, like, things at the threshold. And usually it's like the defendant filing a bunch of motions to try to slow down or prevent the case from, like, getting to what's called, like, the merits phase of the case, where we actually, like, try the case and see if he did the thing he's accused of doing. And ahead of that, you might move to dismiss, which means you might say, look, we don't even need to get into the evidence. The thing you're saying he did, even if all that's true, not a crime. You can make that argument. You can move to transfer venue. You can say, oh, we're not in a place where he can be tried impartially. Everybody already has an opinion. You can make a motion about the judge. You can make a motion about malicious prosecution, which is a thing where you say that the prosecutor is sort of doing this case for ill motives. And honestly, if anybody knows Donald Trump, like,
he's going to do all of these. He's delay,
bury other side in paperwork. And, you know, yeah.
He's going to delay until he's the president again.
And then he can just pardon himself.
Yeah. Well, thank God he can't pardon himself for a New York crime, but they will I would think that if that actually happens, and, like, you know, knock on wood that it doesn't, they would delay the case. I don't think a criminal court's going to find him guilty, going to risk finding guilty while he's in office. I mean, they would just put it on ice.
Yeah.
Do you see any possibility for this to open the door? You know, there's a lot of cases sort of, like, in the ether that involve Donald Trump, because the man's just out here, like, just committing crimes all day, every day. Does having a case like this sort of, like, already out provide any benefit to any of the other jurisdictions that might be looking to prosecute him for things? Is there any reason that that would affect their cases in any way? I'm just curious if, like, multi-crimers out there get protected by their multi-criming or get screwed by it.
No, he's honestly, it's impressive, his, like, crime rate per year. I don't think it makes a legal difference. You know, there are times, you know, and this would be very much more your field than mine, but there are certainly times where lawyers think about the kind of PR and the optics of this stuff. And I think the fact that, like, the dam broke and we crossed the Rubicon of Trump being indicted definitely makes it easier to do it again, because you don't have to think about things like, hey, in addition to trying to find an impartial jury and trying to make sure this appears as not political as possible, which obviously all the various prosecutors have to worry about, you don't have to worry, oh, and I'm going to be the person who ends the 235-year streak of no former president being indicted.
Yeah, and I feel like, also, my other last question on this is, what do you do if there is no world, there's no part of the country, and, you know, when they first tried to talk about changing the venue before any of these, you know, indictments even were released, we talked about it a little bit on the podcast, and we were like, well, where is it that they haven't heard of Donald Trump and don't have an opinion about him? Like, what do you do in a case where there's no truly impartial jury possibility because you were a national figure who everyone has, by their very, you know, existence as a citizen, had to have an opinion on? because he was in an election, in a national election.
Yeah, of course. Like, so, okay, I don't know the like specific doctrine on this, but here's what I do know. You don't need to find 12 people who've never heard of him. Like, that's not the law. And so to the extent he tries to say something like, and I wouldn't put this past him, you know, it's Manhattan. It went, you know, Clinton plus 60. That's not an argument. You know, you need to really find somebody who you say, hey, you know, whether or not you voted in 16 and in 20, do you think you could decide this case impartially? And then if they say, yes, I do, and then you ask two or three follow-ups, and it really doesn't seem like they're have predispositions about, you know, falsifying a business record in the first degree, like that's enough as a basic matter. So the fact that folks have like some opinions of Trump, I mean, the other piece of this is like the legal system operates as a sort of art of the possible. So there isn't some place you could move him. I think that's going to make his argument tougher, not better. The fact that everybody has an opinion is kind of like, yeah, okay, then we probably just have to use a jury pool that, you know, exists.
Right. People that aren't fraudsters. People don't have opinions specifically on committing business fraud.
I'm a little nervous, actually. If you could find 12 people who hadn't heard of Donald Trump, I want to know like how informed and just
those generally. People actually don't seem like right. The right jury. I know.
For sure. Right.
We found a bunch of first graders.
First graders even, I feel like, might be the worst jury for a Donald Trump. They're great judges of character. Is there anything else on the Trump indictment that you wanted to mention before we move on to some of the more timely legal news that we have going on in the last few weeks?
Yeah. Well, look, the wheels of justice turn slowly, so I think it's fine that it took a few weeks. the only thing I would say is any lawyer worth their salt, and I think, you know, I don't know anything like personally about the New York DA, about Alvin Bragg, but like that's a important position. You know that the second you bring this case, the scrutiny is going to be incredible. There's going to be doubt from every single person on the right is going to say this is a hit job. Every single person on the left is going to say about time. So I just, you don't bring this case if you don't have it. And I think that we should remember that like, these are smart lawyers, and it's not, you don't do this for the headline and bail like you might in some other situation. You bring this case only if you've got it on lock. And so I think he's going to have more than just the say-so of known liar Michael Cohen. He's going to have like some docs or some tapes or some something, but like you just don't do this if you don't have a great case. That's also why it's taking so long in the other jurisdictions and why it's so frustrating, but like you just don't do it until you are really, really solid.
Yeah, and I feel like also everyone's gone down for this. So we know crimes were committed. This is like the kind of case where like, we're certain, like if you're involved in the Stormy Daniels payment, like a crime was committed somewhere because everyone's gone to jail for this already.
Well, like, that's another good point. Like the other thing that got a lot of attention, right, Lila, was this idea that like, well, this isn't buzzy enough. This is some little ministerial crime. Well, how about no, like this was lying to conceal something so that you could get elected. Like what's right. A bigger right. Deal than that? I mean, yeah.
Lying to the American people in your presidential race is like actually the biggest of deals.
Yeah. I mean, and to the extent there's a campaign finance element, like that isn't ministerial. That stuff exists so that we can, you know, limit the influence that is had in elections and so that rich people don't get a free pass and so that we have records of who was, you know, contributing in what ways. And like all those things are, you know, are important.
Yeah.
Should we move on to talk about the Fox Dominion settlement?
Absolutely.
Let's do it.
Here's a question, you guys. Can someone explain in layman's terms what happened here?
Is that for Brent?
It's not. I hope not.
Let me do my best.
Okay.
So it was a suit for libel.
Right.
And libel is really tough to prove, especially against the media, right? This was going to be one of the strongest, best libel cases ever, obviously, or they wouldn't have settled it for this much money. And still, it was going to be super tough. So the way this kind of stuff typically works is, you know, they were obviously in discovery. They had exchanged documents. That's how Dominion got a hold of all these like terrible texts for Fox that showed them to be, right, you know, total bullshit artists on the air, like we didn't know. And you're both sides are prepping for trial. And it's not at all surprising that kind of under the radar, they were also talking about trying to resolve this. So, you know, now I think the actual story of how they were doing it was actually that it sort of came together late and was part of it. But the fact that they would be having this conversation, especially on the eve of a big trial, totally normal. And that would all be secret, right? Or it wouldn't work until they announce it. And so then they just reached a deal. And basically, you know, I can tell you that the things that you would consider are not just like, how likely am I to win or lose? But if I'm the plaintiff, I might think something like, how long will it take me to win or lose? Like, okay, if I'm seeking $1.6 billion and I win the trial, and that takes, I'm making this up, 4 months, then they appeal. That takes 2 years. Then they try to go to the Supreme Court. And this definitely gets to go to the Supreme Court. It's a libel case against a media company. So now I'm in another year and a half. Then I win, let's say, and I got to win in the Supreme Court against Fox News with a 6-3 hyper-conservative court. But let's say I win and then they don't pay. And then I have to do a collection suit. And then it just, right? So it starts to cost a long time. I don't have the money. I'm out of pocket. I'm paying lawyers the whole time. If I'm Fox, I'm thinking, what are the odds I win or lose? I'm also thinking, you know, for better or worse, like news stories don't last anymore. So I'm thinking $787 billion. That is a huge number, but it's like a 2-day story. And a trial is like a 6-week story.
Yeah. Well, and so all the things that come out at trial also too, like, you know, just, you know, it would be just be like a daily drip, drip, drip of, you know, whatever insane thing we were learning that we're now not going to learn, which is unfortunate, but you know.
I know. Well, I was excited to learn some of the things that we're not going to learn.
There seemed to me to be an awareness, right, that like, that Dominion had a responsibility to like, get in it. They clearly negotiated that statement that Fox made, right? So Fox says, we're pleased to have reached a settlement in our dispute. We acknowledge the court's rulings finding certain claims about Dominion to be false. I am guessing that one sentence was the subject of days or weeks of negotiating, right? Because Dominion would have said, we want you to say, we acknowledge that those claims were false. And they would have said, no, we're not going to say anything like that at all. And then they settle on, we acknowledge the court's findings that these claims were false. But that was for sure heavily negotiated. And I think Dominion was like, we're not doing, we want a big payout, but we're not doing this if there's not also some wink towards contrition.
Right. Hmm. Oh, interesting. And what are your thoughts on how this relates or doesn't relate to the bombshell news of the last day or two about Tucker Carlson?
That's impossible to know. I mean, hot take, I have no idea. There is definitely a chance that this was part of it, right? You can put anything you want in a settlement agreement and you could say, and it's a secret agreement. So it could say you will get rid of Tucker and they could have negotiated for, again, full speculation. I hope that's allowed on the pod.
Obviously, like, it's mostly full speculation.
It could have been, you'll get rid of Tucker in the next month and you can attribute it to whatever you want. Right. Not so Dominion doesn't get to take credit for it, but they do get to have gotten rid of him. It also could just be Tucker got a little big for his britches. Right. He thought he was so powerful. Rupert Murdoch was like, no, I run this place. You don't run this place. The other like third and related to the second possibility is something like the in-house lawyers at Fox go, hey, look, like this guy's actually not worth the candle. He brings in a ton of viewers. But he also now exposes you to this shit. And I don't think it's going to stop there, right? So it could be sort of an opportunity where you take this big loss and see it as a moment to like send a little signal to the market that's like not some real moral form of being sorry or anything, but just sort of like a, hey, this might help. This might help sell this, that we're at least pivoting in one area.
We see you.
Right. We hear for you.
I don't know if this is on our notes for this podcast, but I'm curious if you know, or does this mean anything for the upcoming additional suit? Don't they have a suit against, or a Smartmatic has filed a similar suit, I think, against them? And if you don't know, no pressure.
No, so there is a similar suit. And, you know, my guess, I don't think we've seen evidence from that suit in the same way we saw these like motions in the Dominion case. My guess is it's probably similarly bad if they get to it. So the typical rule is that you can't use evidence of a settlement in another case. And the reason for that is a pretty good one. It's like, we don't want to discourage settlements. We want to just encourage people to like resolve stuff. And the typical deal is you can't go and say, you know, if you and Lila are both suing me for the same thing and I settled with Lila for a lot of money, it'd be really prejudicial if you went up to the jury and said, he paid off Lila $100,000. He must have done something wrong. That's usually not allowed. Now here, it was like a pretty big story. So I do think it will matter, at least in some soft psychological sense, right? Certainly the judge overseeing the Smartmatic case is aware of this. Certainly, you know, the plaintiff's lawyers are aware of this. And if they have their own settlement discussions, they're going to go, yeah, we know what you value these cases at. And we'd
right.
like dollar for dollar, you know, for whatever our size is.
Right. There's no reason for them to accept less money than that.
Right. Or certainly a proportional amount of money based on whatever absolutely.
Yeah. I think their suit is around the same amount, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, it's a huge number.
Yeah, it's something similar. Yeah. And you said you don't get to like find out what's in the fine print of these settlements. Like we find out what they want us to find out about the settlement, right? Like
that's right. I mean, that's all subject to negotiation usually, right? Right. You could imagine a settlement where the plaintiff says, and one of my conditions is this is all public. You know, you agree that, but I don't think in a case like this, like the money and the statement are the big gets, right? The fact that they're paying $787 million is a lot like an admission.
Right. No, yeah, because right. that could,
this was a
that
pretty big risk to try this case.
Right. Because there's settlements where we don't even hear what the amount is, right? I mean, you can, that, yeah. So,
oh yeah, I guess you can decide that you're going to not release that amount even.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, there's certain cases have certain rules, but yeah. That's definitely a possibility.
And do settlements stay private forever? Like, is that something, because you know how sometimes you hear about like splashy news items where someone like found out the terms of a settlement. Is that because someone got sneaky information or is that because the secrecy expires at a certain point around these kinds of cases?
It probably, so there's kind of two questions in there, maybe even three. Let me total
17 questions.
Out on this. Right. Make it three 10-part questions. Right. No. So in court, you're never going to be allowed to use it. That's because right. of rules of evidence, not anything having to do with the settlement itself. You are not generally allowed to cite a settlement because, again, courts just think we don't want to discourage people from settling their disputes. The terms of the settlement could or could not say this expires. And so that would just be dependent on how the parties negotiated it. But then the last thing is just like reality. Someone might talk at some point.
People
I think that's
gossipy.
Probably not going to happen now because you could have imagined like has the money been transferred yet? Like you wouldn't want to like fuck with that.
Yeah, yeah.
Pardon my French. But like down the road, like, you know, yeah, people talk.
Yeah. The power of human gossip is really unstoppable when you think about it.
Especially on this. A lot of people are involved.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well,
and probably a lot of people who got paid a lot of money but don't love any of the people that were actually involved in the lawsuit.
I did read that that Dominion's lawyer was working on contingency. So this was a good couple of weeks for that firm. Yeah.
Getting a new
200 mil
vacation
or so.
Home.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Oh boy. Any last words on that?
It was going to be, you know, it was going to be an important First Amendment case that everybody would have been watching. And I guess, use this or not, but like, it would have been really, as a legal institutionalist who despises Fox News, it would have been hard to just rule that like they committed libel because someday it's going to be a news organization we think is good. And it's like, you gotta be really careful about that shit. And so it was gonna be a battle forever. And I think it would have been interesting to see it play out. But I think getting that statement and getting the public number and getting everything was like definitely an outcome in the right direction.
Yeah, I'm just now remembering after this entire conversation that I took multiple First Amendment law classes as part of my journalism degree, but it was 23 years ago and I've forgotten all of it. I forgot that I even
I was going to say, do you have wisdom to share with us about
it? None. Forgot that I was even there. That's
how
the wisdom I have to share.
They were. let's talk a little bit about some of the federal court stuff that has broken in the last few weeks and days. We have first, we have this case that ended up going to the Supreme Court about whether or not the abortion pill can remain on the market. That began on April 7th, when a district judge and noted radical person and Trump appointee threw out the FDA approval of mifepristone. Then a judge in like, I think it was in like Seattle or someone was like issued a stay just so that to kind of bump it to the Supreme Court, right? Like that was all just intended to just sort of like get a long, lengthy legal process that would have involved this drug being removed and then put back and then removed and then, you know, like out of the realm of possibility. But what can you tell us about this case and the Supreme Court's sort of choice to issue this stay? But that's pending them hearing a case about this, right? I mean, that's not like a forever, them sort of like keeping mifepristone on the market is not like a forever move, right?
It's not over, right, exactly. So the way this typically works is you use a judicial tool called a stay to basically preserve the status quo while the court decides the case, in a case where a ruling in one direction would sort of really upset the apple cart. And so in a case like this, for example, where a drug has been authorized on the market for 20 plus years, if somebody's gonna rule that it's actually that authorization was invalid and should be taken off the market, that's the sort of thing where like, well, if we're appealing and everything, it makes total sense to stay the order throwing it out until we're really sure that order is gonna stick. You can imagine how like challenging it would be, even setting aside the other ruling in Seattle, just like, okay, it's off the market, then they win, then the government wins the appeal and it's back on the market, and then it goes to the Supreme Court. So it's very common in a situation like this. Something interesting that happened in the Supreme Court is that Justice Alito and Justice Thomas dissented from the granting of a stay. And he basically tried to say, hey, so this came up on what's sometimes called the shadow docket, where it's basically like, mm-hmm. you can send this petition to the Supreme Court, it gets acted on very quickly. There's not a big, oral argument in the courtroom, right, and everything. And he said, hey, some of my colleagues who granted this stay have often criticized my use of the shadow docket. And then he cites, dissents by Kagan, he says this, as being, deciding an issue without airing both sides and blah, blah, blah. And it's a little bit, in my view, not a little bit, it's disingenuous, because in those cases, the like so-called stays were actually upsetting the status quo. And so, and I'll give you an example, like just so that to put a little, so for instance, a radical state like passes an abortion restriction and someone goes to court, challenges the abortion restriction, and the court says, I think you're gonna win and I'm throwing out the new abortion restriction. That really, and that's just preliminary. The real issue hasn't been decided, but it's an injunction. That's really preserving the status quo, because the status quo as of a month ago before there was this law was that for 50 years, pregnant people could get abortions. So it's preserving that until the issue is decided. Now he's saying, no, I'm just staying the order and putting state law back in place, but it's this brand new radical state law. So it really is sort of a different, different situation, in my opinion.
Interesting.
I have a question about the just sort of like larger legal logic everyone is using to make these sort of radical changes to the way that abortion is discussed, allowed, is sort of referenced in law, like, the way that we kind of conceive of the role of law in reproductive healthcare. Because to me, a non-legal expert who's just an idiot reading the news, I feel like the Supreme Court's logic that as I understood it in overturning Roe in the Dobbs decision was essentially that this issue goes back to the states. And I also see how restricting access to a medication kind of contradicts that stance. If at the federal level, the court's stance is like that they can restrict access to a medication that essentially provides like some form of this procedure, I'm just sort of like curious, are they like in any like are they likely to remain consistent on that? Are they legal minds at all? What are the ramifications of them hearing or even changing course on that understanding in this case around mifepristone, if the whole logic of them overturning Roe was like that this is really like a state's issue?
I don't know. I think that's a really good question. I don't think there's a lot of consistency. I also don't think the two cases are super related, candidly, mm-hmm. right? I mean, you're right that a big undercurrent in Dobbs was let's send this back to the states, but it was also like very, in a narrow sense, it was the Constitution itself doesn't have anything to say about this. And so states get to decide. But, you know, separately, the FDA, which is not interpreting the Constitution, is right. a federal agency that decides what drugs are safe and not safe. It's allowed to do that. Nobody disputes that it's allowed or not allowed to do that. And it made a call in 2000 that this drug was safe for its intended use, and it authorized it. There's no law saying that abortion drugs are not allowed. The Dobbs court didn't right. go there. It said the Constitution has nothing to say about abortion. Great. Then the FDA is super allowed to authorize, you know, a chemical abortion drug. So like, they really shouldn't really be talking to each other that much. And what you see is not a lot of consistency, just a lot of, you know, judges on the right who obviously have ideological objections to abortion and are going to try to find their way, you know, into these rulings. It's hard for me to see something much more coherent than that, at least in a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, because it just felt like the courts are just sort of like throwing whatever legal argument seems convenient for their purpose in the current law that they're interpreting or the current case that they're hearing.
They're backing their way into whatever, you know, decision that they want to make, whatever, you know, political decision that it is that they want to make. I mean, I think is sort of what you're getting at.
Yeah, I mean, let's even just put the Supreme Court opinion to the side, because they really were having an argument about like, should we stay this or should we not stay this while the dispute, that could be procedural. The actual district court opinion by the Trump appointee was hot garbage. I mean, it like, just, like there is a statute of limitations on challenging FDA approvals, and it's 6 years. And they approved it in 2000, I think. And then they made the like a slight loosening on the approval, like allowed it for more uses in 2016. This lawsuit was brought in 2023. So it was either 7 years after the 2016 thing, a year late, or it was 23 years after the 2000 thing, and it was 7 years late. Like there was not a good argument that this was on time. And the science in the district court opinion, actually like calling it science is
too generous.
I would say it's inappropriate. So I'll just give you an example from a portion of the opinion. He's deciding whether, you know, the FDA was sort of made a defensible conclusion in saying that mifepristone provides a benefit to patients. And the court cited a study finding that 83% of abortion pill patients reported that it changed them. And the majority of those people said it changed them for the worse. And the study, the footnote cites the source of the study as a website, abortionchangesyou.com. Like that would be like
airtight legal argument right there.
Yeah, that's like saying 100% of people love when I'm a guest on this podcast, and the source is like bensoffnessfanclub.com.
That's wild. Oh, and also, I mean, just like the idea that like this random judge in Texas was like deciding what scientific evidence is and is not legitimate anyway is like kind of absurd, because I don't.
I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt you.
Oh, no, I was going to say they don't make you take science data for dummies classes in law school, do they? Like, there's no like part of the legal education that would make you an expert in this.
No, courts do get to make sure that federal agencies make like sound decisions, that they're kind of rational and like reasonably supported. They are not supposed to sort of second, you know, if the data reasonably allows two conclusions, the agency gets to pick which one. If the data really doesn't reasonably allow two conclusions, a court can go in and say, this actually isn't even like, can't be rationally defended, but like that's the standard. And I think if the FDA decision had that much, you know, was so irrational, someone might have noticed in the last quarter century.
Also, I'm curious what this means in terms of like, does this open the door to just sort of like banning any individual pharmaceuticals people want? Because I mean, just from a political standpoint, like one thing we talked about on the podcast last week was like how dumb it is to take on big pharma. But it's like, because it's the courts, it's like, they're not really like, you know, it, there's not the same kind of like, like politicians have a cash flow from big pharma. So like taking on big pharma has like an immediate consequence to them because, well, you know,
maybe SCOTUS does too. We'll get to that.
That's fair. We don't know about the Supreme Court, but I just mean like, I'm curious sort of, you know, once a court has decided to make radical decisions about like individual things that are on the market.
Well, yeah, I mean, it seems as, yeah, like whoever's
ban anything? Can we ban vaccines? Can we ban a happiness? Can we ban fun times?
You also have to think, I mean, and maybe it's a less interesting story. I don't know. But yeah, I mean, clearly, if you're the drug maker of mifepristone, you're like, wait a fucking minute right now, right?
Yeah.
I mean.
And I would say if you're the drug maker of any drug that has been in the crosshairs of a political conversation, and I'm thinking specifically of the COVID vaccines.
Vaccines, right.
And vaccines in general. Like, are you like, how, now, wait a minute. We paid you guys a lot of money to appoint these judges. And like, is this how we want to play this right now? I'm just sort of like curious if there's, I mean, I know sort of like ideally there would not be political pressure in the court system in this way, but there is. And we know that there is. Is there any like door for pushback on that end? Because I'm sort of shocked that they have chosen to betray their BFFs at Big Pharma this way.
That's a really good point. I don't know. I'm going to leave that to you guys, but I'm going to answer a slightly different question that I think gets at something similar though, which is, you know, can they do this with any drug they don't like? They can try, but I think that there is something unique about the like paternalistic and sexist way that abortion gets treated. And like, let me put a fine point on that. So another problem with the decision was that nobody with what's called legal standing brought this suit. It was brought by a bunch of doctors, and the basic claim was the pill harms patients. And the one of the original arguments that the FDA made was, well, if you're saying it harms patients, standing means I was injured and a legal decision will benefit me and redress that injury. And the FDA said, great, no patients brought this. So
yeah, where are the women who took this? Right.
And they said, no, doctors are harmed too, because they work in emergency rooms and have to deal with, you know, these women who come in who are permanently changed by abortion.
As if that's not their job. Also to be seeing people in an emergency room.
Seeing people in emergencies is.
Well, sure. Right. Fair. Yes.
But it's also this notion that like, oh, because like, and there's even a line in the opinion that's like, perhaps even, you know, because of the personal and sometimes secret nature of abortions, perhaps the doctors are the least awkward plaintiff to bring the suit. And it just has this like current of like, well, women can't handle this on their own because they're so changed and damaged and, you know, so they're the victims of this. Someone has to step up and do it. And it's like, that's not how that works. And I don't think if doctors showed up challenging like the authorization for Viagra, that people would be like, yeah, it's fine to have the doctors do it, not the patients. And so I think that's part of it. But Lyle, I mean, yeah, like this does seem to open a door to a weird avenue of just like, you know, picking and choosing your politically opponent drugs, whatever that even means.
Right. Well, and also, I mean, I think on the flip side, like we often see cases come up where women face serious medical consequences for not having access to abortion care. And I feel like they're not treated with this kind of seriousness most of the time either, which is that the patients are there if we want to talk about cases that have to do with the consequences of not providing this kind of healthcare to pregnant people. And those patients do not get treated with the same seriousness that these poor, kind-hearted doctors who just didn't want to have to treat patients who were sad in the emergency room were being treated with. And I think that's kind of an interesting parallel as well, because we have plenty of examples of how these laws harm people.
Look, and not to be Pollyannish, because I think we all know that like there are definitely courts where it's tough to get, you know, there are definitely a lot of new and not great judges. Hopefully, though, as this case goes and gets decided like in a more fulsome way and isn't just at this preliminary like injunction stage, you will start to hear from more of those parties. I mean, one of the benefits of the agency decision-making process when it works right is that you actually solicit comments from anybody who might be affected by the process. Mm-hmm. And so you'd have certainly like anti-choice people filing comments and submitting their bogus studies, but you'd also certainly have pro-choice people, and you'd have physicians, and you'd have sort of like recognized physician bodies like the AMA, and not just whatever body like brought this lawsuit.
Right.
And you would weigh all of that evidence. And if this ends up being like a Supreme Court case in a year and a half, all of those parties are going to submit briefs, and, you know, hopefully that'll enlarge the record.
Can you just briefly take us through how it does get back there? Like, where is it now after the decision that we did get from them on the shadow docket last week?
Yeah, sure. So the way it first starts with you go in and you ask for an injunction, a preliminary injunction, basically saying, give me temporarily the relief that I would get if I win down the line. Give it to me now, because court, you think I'm gonna win. And if you wait, I'll be irreparably harmed in the meantime. And so it's kind of, for instance, like the easiest situation to think is like, someone's about to demolish your home, right? And you sue, and it might take 6 months to win that lawsuit, but in the meantime, they're scheduled to do it on Thursday. So you get the court to say, look, you gotta make them wait to do it until we're done. That's the sort of irreparable harm they're usually talking about. So a court does that. This has now stayed the court's injunction. So mifepristone is still authorized. Now it'll go back to the district court, and there will be normal sort of arguments and motion practice, probably motions for summary judgment, maybe a trial, but basically like an actual decision on who's right and who's wrong. For sure, whichever way it goes, that'll be appealed to the Fifth Circuit, which is the Court of Appeals in Texas and Louisiana, and I think one or two other states. And then I think it's, you know, pretty much a sure thing it'll go to the Supreme Court. That'll take a couple of years.
Is the stay, you made it seem like it could potentially be indicative of where their head is at on this case. I mean, should we read anything more into it than, I mean, can we read anything
I would say no. I mean, the district court decision was so bad that I actually think like there's a pretty good shot that the FDA prevails in this. I'm not basing that on the Supreme Court stay. I'm basing that on just the fact that like, it seems like there's not a really great case here, and the court has to guard its credibility, and this might not be like the fight it wants to pick, but it really could be, right? So it was, let's assume based on what we know from the Supreme Court, it was 7-2 to put the stay in place. That could be 4 justices who think the FDA should win at the end of the day, and 3 who just think that in the meantime, they shouldn't upset the apple cart. So I think it's tough to,
it's hard
to
make a
guess on that.
Yeah. Got it. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, could that ridiculously bad decision, could that have been a part of their thinking also in their decision? Was like just that literally was so ridiculous that they were like, I mean.
You would hope.
I think. I mean, yeah, it's certainly, you know, look, I mean, the judge is supposed to do, you know, his best job to like defend his decision. That's the purpose of like written opinions. And they must be reading and thinking, if this is the best he can do.
Right.
The notion that the plaintiff, the poor doctors, are probably going to prevail is like a little bit tough to credit.
Sure.
I was wondering if we could move on to talking about, given the tendency of some of these Trump appointee judges to make wild and ridiculous choices in the course of doing business as in judging, the judging business. We're all Californians now. We have a sort of unique interest in a different part of the judicial process, which is how federal judges get appointed and approved in the first place. And the reason that we have a special interest in that right now is because our very own Senator Dianne Feinstein is sort of single-handedly holding up the judicial approval process over in the Senate, thanks to her lingering shingles / potentially just elder dementia situations. So we wanted to talk a little bit about what happens if we just like don't get to the I want everyone to know that Ben could not resist making a pun about the single-handedly comment. He just commented single-handedly. I should have said it. I can't believe I didn't think of it. I appreciate you. I appreciate you pointing it out. Then he's, what happens if she just like doesn't return to the Senate and we just don't continue to, we just like don't appoint judges for a long time?
So Okay, I want you guys to know that I went and learned Senate procedure for this.
I'm so happy.
I know.
To hear it.
I saw
I
you.
Looked up the
I saw
rules
you,
of the Senate.
I saw you put that on the document, and I was like, oh, well, I didn't.
You
I
made
didn't
him do
mean,
research.
I didn't mean for him to have to do that.
I used to bill $900 an hour for this stuff. So, as I understand it, there is nothing. Okay, under the current layout of the rules, there's nothing Democrats can do. They are hoping for basically a courtesy that Republicans have decided they're not going to give. This the way it normally works at the beginning of each Congress or the begin right, the two caucuses go and decide amongst themselves who they're going to put on the various committees, and they get to pick that. But technically, formally, to put any senator on a committee requires a vote of the Senate, and votes of the Senate right. are subject to debate and then subject to cloture, and cloture takes 60 votes, and then you do a vote and you need a majority. So the way it normally goes, each side picks who they want, and then they just do it all by like voice vote or whatever, the unanimous. Right.
They're like, just like, cool, you know, yes, yay, nay.
Right, which is what Schumer tried to do, I think, the first time was to just right. get unanimous consent on your voice.
And I think if she resigned or died or like there was some, you know, I don't know, more ordinary like replacement of a sitting senator, maybe they would be down to let that happen. But I think what they see is a moment of leverage, and they're going to go, yeah, I know that. I mean, this, we've seen this so many times before, like a norm of, yeah, we typically let each side pick who they want in these committees. They're going, yeah, never mind. It takes a full vote of the Senate. We're going to filibuster it. I think that's what's happening.
So what happens with these seats? Like, do these seats just like not get filled? Are there just like legal cases piling up in places that have no judges to oversee cases? Like, what does this mean for the legal system? Sadness? Crises?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. I mean, just to sort of jump off of that, that's sort of what I feel like we're trying to get at. Obviously, I mean, like, you know, I mean, I think the question is basically as simple as like, tell us why judges are important. But also, like, I mean, I think like, you know, more specifically, I mean, I just feel like it's hard to grasp. I feel like everybody knows this is going on, right? And I feel like people got big mad about it for a day and then moved on with their lives. But I mean, like, I guess I'm just sort of like looking for like some explanation of like broad repercussions.
Of why you need to appoint judges.
Yeah, I mean, all the reasons you guys already know, right? I mean, cases pile up, people, especially when it's a matter of, you know, trying to counterbalance a judiciary that is now stacked with Trump appointed judges, right. Like, you know, when you go, look, let's even assume there are enough to handle all of the cases, which honestly, it varies district to district. If you file a suit in a district with a lot of judges, you get put into what's called the wheel, and you get randomly assigned which judge you're going to get. And, you know, the administration wants to increase the odds that the wheel lands on a judge that we think is sort of competent and respects like our values and interprets laws the way we think is appropriate. And so you certainly decrease the odds of that. There is like one on the procedure piece though, just to go back like this, and this is more your lane again than mine, but like you guys talk on the podcast a lot about, you know, Democrats maybe not being like the bravest politicians, you know,
that is one way to say what we talk about on the podcast.
Like such an undersell. The Senate makes its own rules. So the rule that says appointing senators to committees is subject to a filibuster is a rule that could just be changed the same way that the narrow, you know, Senate majorities have changed the rules for filibustering Supreme Court nominees and filibustering lower court nominees. Like they could just, you know, do a 50+1. I mean, maybe they don't have the votes. Maybe they don't have Manchin.
They may not.
You know, our other favorites. But with 50 plus the vice president, you could just change it to majority vote to replace Feinstein on that.
Well, and we've changed a lot of the rules around,
around
specifically
kind of
around judges before in terms of how many votes, you know.
Yes, and usually in situations like this, where the Republicans have all of a sudden decided, oh, this thing that we usually just did as a matter of course for decades, we're all of a sudden not going to do it because we sense an opportunity to kind of screw the other side. So to me, it seems like I'm sure somebody in a room somewhere has thought of that. I'm not, you know, singularly, I learned these procedures 6 hours ago, but it seems to me like something that should be seriously considered.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, I think, the Senate's unwillingness to take actions that they are capable of taking because of decorum and procedures is often a staggering exercise in frustration.
I'm sure the Senate parliamentarian probably told Chuck Schumer that he couldn't do such a thing. And he said, well, we'll never be able to do it again in this lifetime.
Chuck Schumer's boss, the Senate parliamentarian.
Right. No. Well, it's staggering. And it's also one-sided. Only one side has decided to play with one hand tied behind their back.
Right.
Yeah.
No, exactly. Yeah. And then speaking, we have one more topic that is sort of has a relevance to the relationship between Congress and the courts, which is we wanted to talk a little bit about these Clarence Thomas slash potentially every member of the Supreme Court's ethics issues. You know, last week we learned about that Clarence Thomas had been accepting like very fancy travel from a GOP mega donor, who's like a Texas billionaire. And also in addition to like private jets and luxury yachts and such, was also featured in weird oil paintings of them all of them hanging out. We're sort of,
which I don't think is illegal or anything.
No, I don't think that being featured in a mega donor's oil painting is illegal. Sadly, it should be. I just can't think of anything that's more sort of like fitting of a mega donor relationship than also like, in addition to all of the things that like we know rich people do, like sitting for an oil painting, get real, get out of here. That is embarrassing for all of us. That's like Marie Antoinette, you know, like crazy behavior. In any case. We also know that John Roberts declined to testify about these ethics issues on Tuesday to the Senate, citing separation of power concerns, which I think is hilarious considering they're all being wined and dined by ultra political mega donors. In any case, I'm curious whether anyone or anything governs the Supreme Court, if there's anyone who has the power to stop this besides, I guess, just like the mass uprising of the American people, which will not happen, I don't think. And just like in general,
what is this, France?
What do we do about this?
It's not going to happen.
This one's tough. This one's super tough. The short answer is very little governs the Supreme Court. There is, and you know, here's another area where I tried to make myself an expert in the last like 36 hours, but
couldn't be more
there
excited.
Is a law, the Ethics in Government Act, that says all judges, including Supreme Court justices, have to file financial disclosures every year. The challenge is, as with most federal statutes, you typically rely on like an agency or a regulator to like enforce the statute as to, you know, in particular instances. And the agency that enforces it for the judiciary does not have jurisdiction over the justices. So The justices technically have a federal law obligation to do this, but there's no agency actually checking on that to make sure, as there is with like district court judges and circuit judges. Mm.
So basically they have a law that declares that they need to comply with certain ethics requirements, but no one to enforce it.
That's what it looked like to me. The other, awesome. You know, and then the other piece is this sort of self-regulating piece, which I think is sort of non-regulating, which is what the Chief Justice said in his letter to Congress and said, you know, look, we, the justices have all sort of committed to follow the substance of the same guidelines that governs other judges. But I mean, no, it's very loose and it's very voluntary.
Here's a question then. Is it constitutional that we can't in any way sort of impose ethics requirements on judges? Is there a world in which just because this has not been the practice, we could be like, it now will be the practice? Like, does anyone have the ability to impose any sort of oversight that is like not legal oversight, but is oversight into just like the, you know, to making sure that the justices aren't like criminals?
Like, yeah, no, I love this. Just the easy questions. I love this.
Yeah, just the simple questions people are asking. We just want quick yes or no's from you.
New York criminal law, the constitutionality of regulating Supreme Court justice. No, it's cool. I prepped. there are things we can do. Other like countries and states like have systems that regulate judicial ethics. I mean, for one thing, the Supreme Court like runs the Judicial Conference, which is the agency that like oversees federal judges. And they could tell it, you now oversee us too. They could do it themselves. And they could give that body, just as a starting point, they could give that body the ability to like enforce to some degree. Now that would still be like self-regulation in some formal sense, but at least there would be like a body empowered and you could create a committee of, very senior distinguished circuit judges, judges on the level right below the Supreme Court, to like review the justice's disclosures and like look into anything that looks amiss. Now, how motivated would those judges be to dig too deep into the nine judges who review their homework? But you know, you could do something. Congress could pass a stiffer law that requires more disclosures and could create, you know, an agency with the ability to enforce that. Then, Lila, I think you do get into thornier constitutional questions. But look, I mean, there's definitely something you can do because judges get lifetime appointments on, I forget the exact wording, but like on good behavior. They can be impeached for like, you know, they can be impeached for like not respecting the like solemnity of their office. How do you look into that? You know, there's got to be a way. There's got to be some permissible way to look into that. Right now we're doing nothing. There's got to be something between nothing and an unconstitutional level of scrutiny.
Especially because we did make all of this up. Like the whole system's made up by people. So these are only intractable problems if we decide they're intractable, because people can do anything that we decide that we want to do when it comes to this kind of, you know, to when it comes to governing.
Right. I mean, another big problem, of course, right, is that like, just as a reality, as another, like, I hate to be the norm police, but like people care less. I mean, right. Yeah. The big thing in law and in judging is that we care if a judge is biased, like who's partial, but we also care a lot about the appearance of impropriety, right? It really matters that judges are perceived by the public as being totally above board so that when they make a decision that like is adverse to you, you are disappointed, but you respect it as being the outcome of like a process that at least was based on like law and objectivity. And judges are supposed to care, and I think the vast majority do, are care that people who tend to disagree with them nevertheless see them as like honest actors up there. There's obviously an appearance of impropriety here, see all the outrage. And as the country gets more and more divided, it just doesn't seem like people care about that much anymore. I didn't get the sense that Justice Thomas was like bent out of shape, that folks primarily on the left like saw this as a problem. He was perfectly happy to say, hey, as I understood it, technically I didn't have to disclose this and then be happy that he retains his post. And it doesn't seem like the folks, like people on the right, are upset at how it looks. They're just happy that they have, you know, their guy.
Isn't the person who supposedly cares about this, and everybody always talks about how he cares so much about this, John Roberts? Isn't he the one who's always talking about like making sure that he was going to uphold the legitimacy of the court and the, like, isn't that his whole brand?
It's his brand. It's definitely his job. He's, you know,
that's interesting.
He's definitely got a tough, I am more of a fan of Chief Justice Roberts than of Justice Thomas. And I think I was disappointed.
That's low bar.
I know, hot take. I was disappointed at what he said to the Senate, to the Judiciary Committee. But I do think he's balancing a lot of tough things. You know, according to his letter, the Chief Justice has come before the Senate Judiciary Committee like four times in history. So it would for sure be momentous. Now, you know, this does seem like there is
this maybe an
emergency
a time
level, of like lack of confidence in the integrity of the justices. So, you know, his compromise was to say, I'm submitting this set of principles that all nine of us have subscribed to, but it was pretty weak tea, in my opinion.
Also, are there not ways to exercise like softer power in these kinds of situations? I mean, whether or not the Scottish judges want to believe that they are sort of like above politics, we all know that that's not true, and also that they exist as part of the political system. When something like this happens in the broader political system, someone gets in your ear and is like, dude, you should resign because otherwise we're going to make your life a living hell, which is how you get people, you know, it's how you get Nixon out. It's how you get you know, high profile leaders to resign from their posts is, you know, instead of having to impeach them, instead of having to remove them from office or whatever. I'm just sort of like shocked that there's not a sort of similar, and maybe there is, I could be shocked because I don't know about it. But, you know, effort underway to essentially, you know, try to use soft power to pressure some of these problematic figures in both the Supreme Court, but also in other courts that are causing drama for everyone. Like, to kind of step back for the good of the judicial system as a whole.
Well, it's very touchy because the people have become so polarized, right? Like it worked on Nixon when enough of both sides had sort of realized it had gone too far. And even though I think this case looks as bad as it looks, that's just not the case right now. There just isn't a chorus of people willing to do that. And if you're shy of that, it's very hard to be the person who goes out on a limb with someone with that much power and says that. Certainly like the president can't do that with the amount of like, it would be, I think, politically very problematic. Though, Lyle, I'm surprised you don't know what I'm about to say, which is like, in addition to soft power, there are like hard power concerns. Congress funds the Supreme Court.
Right.
They turn the lights off.
You talked about this last time, and that was the last thing I wanted to ask you about.
But there is a turn the lights out. There's a turn the lights out angle here. So at the end of the Chief Justice's letter, he said, you know, while we're talking about ethics, it's worth making a note about security. There have been recent threats on the justices. And I think that was like a not so subtle allusion to like increase our security budget. Now, look, I'm not a political expert, but there's doing this with carrots and there's doing this with sticks. It could be like, we'll give you the security budget when we also give you this new oversight, or when you agree to submit yourself to this level of oversight. Or it could be, you know, whatever. There's obviously ways to bargain there, and maybe that's...
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
Another interesting negotiation point brought to us by our legal expert, Ben Softness, Esquire. I've been trying to say work in Ben Softness, Esquire this entire time.
Well done.
Is there anything else that you want to add to this, or anything else that you wish that we would cover before we let the people... I don't know, release the people to their less exciting podcast fates.
Yeah, anybody who's still listening after having heard me speculate about the law.
Honestly, I feel like we have like covered a lot of issues that are
this is interesting.
We've covered a lot of the questions that people who are not lawyers have about these legal cases, which is why I think it was fitting to do a legal spectacular for them.
I think there's one other soft power thing, and I really urge you to consider whether you use this or not.
we're going to definitely use it, by the way.
You know, in the same way that the justices don't seem to want to do what people want them to do, right, and submit to some kind of an ethical whatever, like structurally, courts don't have a lot of hard power, right? They decide cases. Now, if it's a dispute between like me and Brent and I disobey a court order, like the court can order a marshal to go like make me do something physically. But if it's a dispute between like the FDA and a bunch of doctors and the Supreme Court says, yes, we hereby invalidate the FDA's approval, that doesn't like take the approval out of the FDA's logbook. Like someone at the FDA has to do that. And the FDA, if courts became sufficiently unserious or sufficiently sort of untrustworthy, government agencies could start to be like, no.
We don't care what they have to say.
Doing it. Now that's obviously like, that's extreme, going right. Very nuclear. That's like not living in a place governed by the rule of law anymore. And it's like very, very scary stuff. But it's just to be like, it's worth saying only because it's a good reminder that a lot of the power that we say courts have comes from the amount of like inherent authority and trustworthiness and integrity that they have. It's why they have so much pomp and circumstance. It's why they're in these buildings with big columns and have a big frieze over it and sit up on an elevated platform in a robe. It's all to like signal really loudly that this is solemn work being done, and they are setting aside their personal identity in favor of this really important, you know, role they're playing as a judge. And if they aren't, you know, then a lot of that is harder to sort of let operate in the normal course.
Sounds like anarchy. I like it.
Right. It would be a little bit like anarchy. I'm not recommending it. That's step 603, and we're at step 2.
No, but there is something important in remembering that a law that isn't respected by anyone is not really a law. Like it's ultimately like our choice to conform to the rule of law is in part because we consent to the laws. It's not just because that is how things are. We, like I said, we made all of it up. Like, you know, if they decide that they're making up a new system that we don't consent to, that's, you know, that's risky, not just as a nuclear option on our end, but it's risky on their end as well. They're the ones who are also disrupting the rule of law if they start issuing rulings that don't conform to anyone's understanding of what the law is and should be. So
what do you call a leader with no followers? It's just
exactly
a guy taking a walk.
Right. In any case, thank you so much for joining us.
That's a good one to end on.
Yeah, that was a perfect one to end on. This has been really interesting. Anyone who's an interesting person made it to the end. So don't worry about that. They all heard your final pearl of wisdom. But is there anything that you want to add about how people can, do you need Twitter followers? Do you have a book that's coming out? Do you want to promote anything?
Yeah, follow me at I Am Softness, the letters I Am and Softness.
Perfect. And we'll put that in the show notes as well so that people can, I don't know, if Twitter's still there, they can hear your genius legal thoughts.
3 or 4 times a year, yeah.
Right, exactly. In any case, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.